This podcast is for informational purposes only and does not constitute legal, tax, investment, financial, or other advice. It is not intended to cause or induce breach of an existing agency agreement.
Hello?
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 This is the Vancouver
Commercial
Real Estate Podcast.
And welcome back to the Vancouver Commercial Real Estate Podcast. I'm Corey Wright, and I'm the only one you're getting today. But today's episode is outstanding. We have Greg Mitchell, director of the GDM Consulting Group on. We're talking everything development. A lot of people may not understand the entitlement process or how the developer world gets from dirt to occupancy. So today we're unpacking everything with Greg Mitchell, great guy. Known him for a while. He was very generous to donate his time to come see us today. So we're very appreciative of that. Other big news, obviously, this is when are we recording this? We're recording this on Tuesday, April 29th, which is a little bit late for our weekly recording. So this episode will get out this week at some point. But yesterday we had our big federal election out there. It looks like we have a minority liberal government in place. We are going to be covering that, how that could potentially impact commercial real estate and real estate in this province as well as the country. I can say from a real estate community standpoint, I think it will be kind of a optimistic, slow entry back into a few things. I think a lot of people, although it's a new face of the Liberal Party, it's still the same cast of characters for the most part. I think a lot of people want to see how that kind of plays itself out before they get too optimistic and pull their wallets out just yet. But on combating that comment, we've seen transactions go up for 5-6 weeks in a row now at William Wright Commercial, which is a great sign that people are kind of coming back out. It does kind of feel that, you know, the tariffs and Trump and all this stuff, it does feel like maybe that's a little bit just part of life right now. And more people are coming back to the table than we saw before. So be interesting to see how that goes. But a lot of that we're going to cover in our some upcoming episodes talking about how the new federal government could impact commercial real estate here in BC. But let's get to our episode today with Greg Mitchell, Director, GDM Consulting Group, and we're talking development. Enjoy, guys. This podcast is presented by Impact Commercial.
Impact Commercial, John, Alan, the team over there are fantastic. They've all been on the show.
They have, yeah.
Friends of the show.
Great guys.
Wealth of experience. They can help with all your commercial financing needs.
Whether it's owner-occupiers, land development funds, commercial investments, or multifamily, these guys got you covered.
And they recently obtained their CMHC correspondent lender status.
So for all your commercial lending needs, visit them at impactcommercial.ca.
That's impactcommercial.ca.
This podcast is sponsored by Atlin at Clayton Crest, a master plan community in the West Clayton area built by Zentera Developments.
Zentera is an absolute force, Adam. They've been nominated for Multifamily Builder of the Year for 10 consecutive years and just won again at the Georgies for 2025 Multifamily Home Builder of the Year.
What's really exciting about Atlin is the West Clayton location. You're within walking distance to the future SkyTrain station, giving you that perfect balance of city access while living in a peaceful, family-friendly community in the Fraser Valley.
And if you have kids or are planning to start a family, there's an on-site daycare where residents get first access. This kind of thoughtful planning is why Zentera's projects stand out in the market.
The amenities at Atlin are incredible too, Matt. A rooftop patio with stunning views, fitness center, co-working space, and lounge areas for events. The outdoor space is extensive with 2 fitness areas, 3 children's play areas, and multiple spots to relax.
With major investments happening in the SkyTrain and the 72nd Avenue extension, West Clayton is set for explosive growth. This is genuinely one of those opportunities to invest in a community before values skyrocket.
And that's really the key here. This isn't just about finding a beautiful place to live. It's about making a smart investment in your future as the whole area continues to develop.
Pre-sales for Atlin will begin soon. Register today at atlincondos.ca. That's atlincondos.ca.
All right, we're here today with Greg Mitchell, director of the GDM Consulting Group. Greg, how are you doing today?
I'm doing very well. How about yourself?
Great. Well, thanks so much for taking the time to join us. We really appreciate it. I'm looking forward to this episode because I know we'll get into the crux of it here pretty quick, but I think a lot of people have a lack of understanding of how the development, the entitlement process works. So today we're going to kind of break that down a little bit. But Greg, before we do that, can you tell us a little bit more about yourself and the GDM group?
Sure. Yeah, no, my background is urban planning. Probably comes from playing SimCity in high school. And unlike some of my compatriots at UBC, I didn't continue down the business stream. I hit urban geography and fell in love with it. And headed off after undergrad in geography back east to Queens, and then did my master's in urban and regional planning back there. Came back to BC and started my career. It was with a short interlude in Australia to travel and surf.
Absolutely. Absolutely. How was that? How's Australia? I've never been, and I'll be honest with you, I don't know if I ever really had a desire to go. And then I was watching the Lux listings or Lux Sydney listings on Amazon, and it was kind of like a $1 million listing show, but in Sydney, and the area and the houses look spectacular.
Yeah, Sydney is a city that indeed Vancouver should learn a lot from in terms of how to utilize its waterfront. We don't do our waterfront justice.
Yeah, I agree.
Ferries there run like buses here. And some of the ferries for the $3 crossing or whatever, it was to a community called Manly, which is like Kitsilano. The ferry from downtown Sydney to Manly, which is like a half an hour, is a tourist attraction in and of itself. And it's spectacular. Wow. And get the opera house and fun stuff like that. But yeah, I surfed through Australia. It was amazing. I haven't been back since, but I'm still a surfer. And my boss at the time before I traveled was a planner at UBC, and he actually hired me on contract with the understanding that I would go traveling, because he basically was like, you can't be a good planner if you don't see the world.
Yeah, that's actually a good point.
Yeah, so Fred Pritchard, who passed away sometime last year, was my boss at the time, and he sent me traveling, and then I came back and really sort of started working in the field of urban planning, and then moved over to development after about 6 years in the city of Surrey.
Well, that's what we're hopefully going to unpack today, is how does that planning process work? Because I know a lot of people, you know, maybe they might have an idea, or maybe they have no idea. How do houses, dirt, how does that planning process work? How does one get from the start of the development phase to the occupancy phase? So I'm going to give you a lot of runway here to work with, because I'm excited to hear all about this. So I'm a landowner, or I'm a potential wannabe developer, or maybe I'm a developer. I've acquired this land. Greg, what do I do and how do we do this?
It should be a lot simpler than it is. Yeah. I'm just going to call it spade a spade. It should be a lot easier and more straightforward than it is. And I think some of my planning colleagues who are sort of city side planners are starting to perhaps see that we've just bogged ourselves down in regulation, and maybe things are changing. And I say maybe because the proof's in the pudding. The province has come down hard on a lot of that and is starting to force cities to make some changes. That being said, it is easier than people think as well. Okay. Most cities have great information about what land uses are. Most communities have the official community plan, which is the foundational plan. These foundational plans talk about general land use themes, concepts for how communities want to develop. Usually very in-depth processes, 18 months to 2 years to do these plans. And those become the guidelines. We'll talk about multifamily and park space and where they want to preserve heritage or natural areas. It all filters down to that OCP. And then there's neighborhood plans. Then there's the official community plan. And then it becomes the zoning and all that. So at the end of the day, it's probably anywhere between 5 to 10 policy plans or a piece of property in an average municipality. And that can be the zoning rules, that can be development permit areas, that can be all of these things you have to consider in an application. I've been development side now for the better part of 12 years after spending some time consulting with McElhaney and then sort of moved over to private side development. And it is a lack of communication between cities and staff there and developers that is probably the crux of our challenge, because developers want all the information quickly. Cities need all the information to feed council. Yeah. And it's not easy, but when you have that great communication, it makes a big difference in getting projects quickly. Staff make a huge difference when they are see themselves as partners, not barriers. I certainly had that experience with some communities on the island where from application to council, it's 9 months, which is lightning fast. Okay. I've also had the opposite side where acquisition to council to a building permit has been the better part of 9 years. Projects wow. I'm no longer involved in the city of Vancouver. City of Vancouver is notorious. We're starting to maybe see some changes that things have to happen faster. Obviously, we've got a housing crisis.
Yeah.
I'm a big housing advocate. And we're just at this point now where if things don't change more quickly and planners don't kind of wrap their head around the changes that are coming, and the province is going to start making some fundamental shifts in how land developments get approved.
You know, I got a million questions. I'll be the first to say that I am not a developer by any stretch of the imagination. I understand the process because obviously we deal with developers quite often and we'll assist where we can. I have this piece of land, let's say, and OCP allows for a 2.5 FSR. And for those who may not know, it's floor space ratio, also could be floor space area, which kind of the quick math is, you know, 10,000 square foot site, 2.5 FSR, multiply the 10,000 by 2.5. 25,000 square feet of gross buildable. There's probably a lot more metrics that go into that. I'm just trying to dumb it down here with my pastels as I'm coloring in the lines here to try to make it easy for everyone to understand. So I have
your Crayola.
Exactly. So I've got this piece of land and it's zoned for this. The size of the land, maybe through an assembly or a single parcel, allows me to build this. Do I have to go? Is there any clear path to developing this, or do I have to go to public hearings? Do I have to walk me through that process? Because I know, you know, not so much right now, but there was a lot of people years ago that wanted to get into development because prices were going up and everyone, you know, thought it was them. How does that process work from the time a landowner contacts you potentially to engage your services? Like, can you maybe just walk us through just the high level of what those steps are?
Sure. The first thing, I call it due diligence, even before you kind of close on the property. And nothing against brokers, but brokers are often optimistic as to what can often be built.
Absolutely.
So a mapping analysis, a review of what the numbers need to be for the client to make sense. If somebody's telling me a 100-story tower goes on a place that can't fit it because it's not even big enough, then there's obviously a bigger challenge. And it all comes down to intent, use, timelines, costs. So where I like to get involved is dealing with cities, and that is the first conversation with staff. Hey, we're looking at building, in this case, call it a 6-story rental building. It's permitted in the zoning and in the OCP. Are there any red flags to us? Perhaps the plan, the policy says 4 stories, but 6 stories makes the numbers work.
Yeah.
Let's talk six. Let's 6 stories is where we need to be. So can we vary the height? Can we amend the policies? Do we go through a rezoning process? Well, the province has actually kind of short-circuited a lot of what used to be the challenging public hearings through their recent provincial legislation. So if something is permitted in an OCP, the city can ignore a public hearing. It doesn't mean that there's not public input. It just isn't this opportunity to, in some cases, grandstand at council to say, hey, I don't like this rental building being in my neighborhood or something like that. So that stress of has happened. Public hearings still occur. We saw it with the Jericho lands recently, where it's major projects of public interest, major OCP amendments, where those still happen. But okay, we talk to staff, we get a good sense that yeah, okay, they're okay. They've got some questions, but they're willing to accept a 6-story. So let's come up with a schematic design, working with a qualified architect. My schemes are usually boxes, whereas the architects obviously make it a lot prettier. Then we start talking to staff. We say, okay, these are what we're talking about. We hit the OC or we hit the FAR. One neighbor is concerned about a tree. Well, maybe we tweak the design. Maybe we pay for the tree. Like it becomes this dialogue between staff, the client, the developer, and the neighbors in some cases to find that middle ground or design that really works, that sings, that makes money, that looks good, and can get approved. And even though it sometimes is front-loaded with the city process, engineering, the arborist report, the surveys, if you have a design the city's generally supportive, you can actually move through the process far quicker than you think, as long as the developer is willing to make fast decisions. That's the one area where I defend some of my planning colleagues on the city side is often they have 40, 50, 60 applications on their desk for projects. And if a developer has gone silent for 4 months, that project does not become front of mind. So a bit of squeaky wheel, a bit of recognition that they're busy. How do you make their lives easy? I basically like to write my covering letters as if it's their planning report so that they can pretty much look and copy and paste, because then you're making their job easy. You're hitting all the high notes and hopefully the process goes seamlessly.
So I think it's important. So, Greg, finish your thought.
I was going to say, but then nothing ever goes to plan, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Welcome to real estate.
Everything's great until you get punched in the eye.
Yeah, exactly. Welcome to real estate. So I think it's important to know. So every city, so for the listeners that may not know this, every city deals with their own development. It's not a province-wide thing. So if I'm in Surrey, they may have a slightly different process or maybe some different policies than maybe I'd find in Burnaby, Vancouver, or maybe even in Nanaimo for that fact. Am I correct in saying that?
Yeah. So in British Columbia, and there, I think there's resort municipalities, municipalities governed by the community charter. And then you have the city of Vancouver, which has its own Vancouver charter. So
yeah.
The city of Vancouver is an aberration. They have their own process. They can control their own building permits. It's much more complicated in the city of Vancouver. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. It is a much harder place to do development. But every other jurisdiction generally has the same regulatory process, which is first, second, and third reading, which is council preliminary approvals.
Yeah.
You go away for a period of time. You do all the prior two conditions, the legal agreements, the final designs, if there was anything to tweak. And then fourth reading, which is bylaw adoption and final adoption of the bylaw. And usually the development permits for your project are issued at the same time. Then the developer has something that stands for something. They are permitted to do this thing on this piece of property by law.
So I have this DP or development permit in my hand. How long? So my next step after that is I have to apply for my building permit, which then actually allows me to physically put shovels in the ground. How long do I have after I get my DP until I have to either file or obtain my BP before that DP kind of goes away?
So a development permit is before a building permit.
Yeah.
But there is, if you're confident in a design, you can be working on the building permit background drawings at the same time.
Gotcha.
So you can do a bit of concurrent process. I usually like to figure there's about a 3 to 6 month overlap.
Okay.
I'm pretty confident in your design and it's your legal agreements, for example, that might take some time. Well, your design's not changing. Great. You can start your BP work. So every project's a little bit different. But once you're issued your development permit, I believe you get 2 years to begin work or submit your building permit. Otherwise, your development permit can lapse and you have to go back to council, arguably, or sometimes staff will renew it for a fee.
Yeah.
We're hearing that, or I'm certainly hearing that a lot right now, is a lot of permits that may have been pulled sort of 18 months ago, development permits, are lapsing because the markets have changed, there's uncertainty, what was designed 3-4 years ago no longer makes financial sense. So there's a lot of going back to the drawing board and going back to sharpen pencils and do more value engineering, sometimes change the design altogether and start from scratch. I mean, it's a really topsy-turvy world right now.
And that's kind of a case-by-case basis, I'm guessing, at, you know, every individual city. Now, there's I'm not going to say this city's name, but we hear a lot of grumblings and is originally there was an OCP brought out. The previous council had kind of said, like, hey, if your proposal meets the new OCP requirements, you don't require a public hearing. This market became very attractive to developers. There's also grid population growth. New council gets in, and they've been apparently sending people to public hearings, even though it meets the requirements of the new OCP. Is there a lot of stories like that where councils change or planning departments change, and then the policy or the steps potentially could change and throw a wrench into a developer's plan?
It ends up being council's prerogative to make that decision. I mean, I believe the requirements for a public hearing lie entirely with council. Council can choose to not have one in certain cases for social housing or rental housing that's compliant with the OCP, but it doesn't mean that councils have to do it that way. So the onus then becomes on the developer to really work with the community. And that's getting out there, having conversations, spending some time in the communities. I had a project in Victoria where over the course of a year and a half, 4 or 5 meetings with the community, another 6 coffee conversations with neighbors, took a project from basically people threatening to chain themselves to the trees to, we don't love it, but we understand it and we're not opposed to it. And again, it takes that sort of regular communication, willingness to be open and honest on a developer side.
Yeah.
And be transparent. So I would say to the neighbors, like, tell me what you want. And if it doesn't hurt the project financially, I can consider it.
Yeah.
And if it's going to hurt the project, I'll be honest, I can't do it, but I'll tell you why. And that sort of transparency and honesty makes a huge difference when and if you do go to a public hearing. Because the worst thing to do at a public hearing is have somebody stand up and say, no one ever came to speak to me.
Yeah, good point.
Versus they may be opposed to it. And that is that if somebody's right, that's okay. But if they've never been approached or no opportunity to speak to it directly to a developer has ever been offered, it looks far worse for the developer.
Is it quite common that council will come back to developers? And again, this is a case-by-case basis, city-by-city basis, where they're kind of come back with a wish list and the developers are just kind of like, I can't do that. Like financially, that's going to just destroy this project. And then you maybe get some very unreasonable people in council that just put their heels down because they have a vision for a particular property that is financially unachievable in the current market.
Usually by the time a project reaches council, you've gone through that process with staff. Staff are actually the bigger barrier. They have their pet projects. Parks wants X, engineering wants a wider road.
Yeah.
The school nearby wants a new playground. Like you have all these people with their hands out at that application stage because when an application goes in, the city sends all these referral letters out to all the parties, fire departments, police departments, parks, arborists, everything like this. And they all come back with their like wish list. And then it takes a bit of that massaging of a plan and conversations with the city to say, hey, well, this is unreasonable. Maybe we don't need to offer 5 meters of a road dedication you're never going to build. Maybe there's another option. And so that back and forth conversation happens before it even gets to council. Hopefully, you've addressed all of those big issues before council. And council gets the good news from staff, which is, hey, the developer has done all of these wonderful things. And maybe they couldn't do X and Y, but they've done all these other things, and we believe that the project should be supported. Developers also have what I call the nuclear option, okay, to go against staff recommendation and send a project to council regardless. It is I've only done it twice. Once was successful, once was not. And it was, like I say, it's the nuclear option. You don't leave a good taste with staff if you want to have a long collegial working relationship in those situations.
I've heard stories of not combative developers, but people who are very passionate about what they wanted to do and it would kind of didn't have the support going into it and just never feels like they get the outcome they're looking for 9 times out of 10. I'd also be very curious, like if you're looking down the province at a bird's eye view, is there communities or municipalities that are more developer-friendly, let's say? Maybe it's a faster timeline. Maybe they're more open to kind of ideas. And I'll use one as an example. We had the previous mayor of Langford on before with us, probably a couple of years back now. And he was very much pro, we're open for business. And very much bring your ideas, bring your drawings, bring everything together. Let's work together. Let's get this going. And you can also see how fast Langford grew. And for those who haven't been to Langford for a while, if you went a decade ago and today, you wouldn't even recognize everything that's there now. Is there more developer-friendly communities out there that are kind of like with their hands in the air, come see us, we want your business?
100%. And it exists in sort of the bell curve. You've got communities that are like, hey, like developers, come in, do what you want within reason. I say that somewhat tongue-in-cheek. But come in, we want your business, we want your development. How can we help you? And that becomes the difference, I find, with cities is how can we help you get approved as opposed to this is what we want from you to get approved.
That makes sense.
And I was dealing recently with a project on Vancouver Island, one of the Mid-Island projects. our mid-island communities. And the director of planning basically was like, how can we help you get approved? And it wasn't a hat in hand, what can you give us? It was, how can we help you get approved? Yeah, we got these policies and these things over here. We can talk about that. But what do you need?
Wow.
We were able to express what we were bringing, which was over 200 rental units in an area that was under service. And that was the 9 months from application to council approval, because the director of planning, and it is a staff thing many times, was like, great, how can we support you? They get their pound of flesh, right? Yeah. Cities will get their pound of flesh. But that time value money proposition of getting something faster makes the developer much more likely to be able to be offer more.
Yeah.
Right? If point. You're shaving a year or 6 months off an approvals process, well, that's a lot of time value and money to a project that arguably a developer should be willing to be like, hey, yeah, that school playground does need an upgrade. I'm happy to contribute because you've just knocked a year off a project. Other communities I've dealt with, the exact opposite. What can you give us? I had a project. It was a minor OCP amendment, one of the Tri-Cities communities. It was an OCP amendment dictated by literally fractions in this case. It was just to fit so many lots on a certain site, we needed to vary a thing by decimal points. But because it required an OCP amendment, they're like, what will you give us? And it was like, no, this is just rational thought here. And that was a fight. That became an argument between us and staff, and ultimately council made the decision.
Yeah. See, I look at it, and obviously I'll be the first, like I said it before, I'm not a developer and I don't have the stomach to be a developer, but I would think that if I'm a community, and I think developers get painted with a bad brush that, hey, you're making all this money, you greedy SOB. And if I'm a city, I'm like, hey, I need you as much as you need me. I need population. I have housing problems here. That's going to generate property tax for our community. It's going to bring in hopefully some really good amenities or some great animated retail in the building and all of that stuff, that I just never, ever got the idea of how a city would kind of take a negative approach towards it, especially in today's world where we have housing crunches and we have all this stuff that we have to deal with. Why wouldn't you be more willing to work with them and less combative with it? The story you shared there about a Tri-City city, we've heard similar ones from developers. And to your point too, about the timelines, when we're dealing with it on the brokerage side of things, one of the biggest challenges for developers is the holding cost. When I close on the land till I can actually get a shovel in the ground and eventually get it to occupancy. And I know 1 year closings, sometimes even 2 year closings, are not a completely unreasonable request from a developer, because they're just like, it's going to put seven figures on my on my proforma if I have to close today and sit on this for 24 months before I can potentially get a shovel in the ground to get moving on this. That changes everything. And when you talk about affordable housing costs, developers have to show a minimum profit to get funding from the bank in order to build. And if their performers are going out by seven figures in some cases because of the holding costs, all of those costs just trickle down to homeowners eventually, because they can't build them if they can't profit from them because no one's going to fund them. So exactly. I just never got the understanding there. I guess the question for me is commercial versus residential. Is there a timeline that goes faster if I was, say, building, you know, concrete tilt-up strata lots, or sorry, industrial small bay strata lots? Is there a much faster process to go through versus going through the housing side, or is that a community by community question again?
It's community by community. Tilt-up industrial is, I mean, we're obviously desperately low of industrial land in the Lower Mainland. I believe you had Eric Adernek on your show.
We did.
A few weeks ago.
Yeah, great guy.
About that.
Great guy.
I went to grad school with him. He's a fantastic resource. And we're desperately low of industrial land. So when a creative, well-designed industrial project comes in, most cities are jumping at the chance because they know how important it is for sort of larger economic development.
Yeah.
You see serious success with Campbell Heights. There's some business industrial. You see the intra-urbans from PC Urban projects, like just flying along again, one of your previous guests.
Yeah.
Doing some great projects. And those are the projects that are getting success and getting staff excited. Conwest is another developer. I absolutely love
great developer. Yeah.
Their Riverworks and their Ironworks buildings are great examples of creative industrial. And those work best when cities get out of the way.
Yeah. Yeah. I will say with the Ironworks building is, I've been in this the brokerage business for quite a while now. The Ironworks building in East Vancouver there is one of my, if not my favorite development project I've ever toured. Just how the office spaces and the industrial spaces, and just, it's spectacular. So anyone who's kind of like an architect buff, you got to go look at the Conwest project and the PC Urban's thing too. They are a great builder and they build some spectacular projects. We had Anthony on. We were talking about one of their amazing projects in Coquitlam there and their Eagle Ridge Interurban project, another best-in-class type asset built by a great developer there that we're desperately needing. Sorry, continue your thought there on the time process. You talked about a couple of things that got me excited there.
You're talking to somebody who nerds out for stuff like this. The running joke in my family is this is how we die in a car crash, because I'm constantly looking out the window at buildings when we're driving places. Because like, oh, that's a new building. Oh, that looks good.
I'm with you, because when I'm on the road,
stealing ideas.
When I'm on the road for work, I'll get up at some god-awful hour and I'll get Tim Hortons and I'll drive around Kelowna or Victoria or Nanaimo, and I'm driving two buildings and I'm parking and I'm getting out and I'm like walking the site. That someone probably is going to call me and think I'm going to go rob something. But I can spend hours driving around just looking at buildings. And my family doesn't get it because they're like, it looks like a concrete box. I'm like, oh, but you have no idea about the mezzanines in there. So it's just like, yeah, I'm with you on that.
I mean, to that point, like, and sort of a slight aside, my first job was in sort of peer development, was with PCI, and I was working on the hub at King George Station.
Oh, yeah.
And my boss at the time basically said, you can't know a site until you walk it. Like, Google Maps is not good enough.
Yeah.
You need to walk the site, walk around it, understand context, cross the street, look at it from every different angle you can imagine. And that's been a lesson I've taken with me throughout my career since, is just walking the site, even if it take some time to get on a ferry or go somewhere and explore, you get a much better sense of what can be built creatively.
Yeah, on these great project.
What I'd say about this, or going back to the industrial residential is harder. There's a lot more nuance to it. There's a lot more, you're dealing with people, how they move through space. And so you have to consider a lot more details. BEPTED, crime prevention through environmental design, lighting, it becomes much more comprehensively designed. So it does take longer.
Yeah.
Once you have a design, though, while the drawings take longer, the process through the city is not that much longer. It's actually the drawing time up front, understanding what you want from a rental or condo perspective, putting that on paper that makes sense financially, and then working with the city on the sort of small scale stuff, because they're not generally concerned about two units, or cities aren't as concerned about parking as they used to be.
Yeah, that makes sense.
It's more about the big picture, the roads, the pathways, the connections, your access to the street.
Yeah.
And so those issues are pretty standard, and some of the good architects know how to work the plans really well to address most of those up front.
Yeah, great point. Great point. We had, before I forget too, for those people who are talking about, like, you know, we had Brad Howard on of PCI a while ago, probably last year, and he came on to talk all about the hub there. And it was a very interesting episode. And he kind of comments a lot similar to like when you walk the site and you see it and you feel it, you get a much better idea than looking at it through Google Maps and all that stuff. So it's a really good episode to go back and listen to. People find the time there. I guess, Greg, as a final question, I mean, I'm getting my pen out here so I can take these answers down here. Is there any markets that you're seeing where developers are kind of more active in the land acquisition side, maybe than some other markets right now?
I think, and it kind of goes to what we talked about earlier, there are communities in which, and again, put Vancouver in its own category, because Vancouver is the heart of the Lower Mainland, and as much as Surrey is growing and is going to surpass Vancouver in population, Vancouver will still be the sort of the central hub. And I say planning 101, just that's how Vancouver was designed and planned. Like, we are started as a streetcar community in downtown Vancouver and expanded outward.
Yeah.
But taking Vancouver out of the equation, I think you're seeing sort of the Tri-Cities obviously booming and really positive councils supporting development. You see Fraser Valley booming, councils really supporting development. Surrey used to be kind of a bellwether community for development. I think they got a lot more sophisticated, and it has bogged down their process, though there's still an excellent community in which to do business. I actually find the smaller communities on Vancouver Island to be the ones that are most pro-development and have, I think, the most opportunity for some creative developments. And not even the Victorias and Nanaimos, it's the secondary communities on the island that have housing needs like every other community.
Yeah.
But they are often overshadowed by the larger communities. And as a result, a creative developer who's willing to work with the city, I think there's a lot of opportunities in those communities.
Yeah.
I know I'm not a developer. I'd love to be it. I'm looking at different things here and there and looking to see what makes sense and pencils out. And Vancouver Island is high on that list of places where demand is going to remain high. I mean, you just have to look at the weather today. Blue sky, it's sunny.
Yeah.
It's April and people are golfing. And Vancouver Island is the most amazing place. I grew up in Vancouver Island, so I'm partial to the place.
Yep.
And BC is obviously home. And so like we are spoiled rotten. People are coming here. They're going to want to live here. We need the housing to support it. We need the job space to support the people. And that's not changing despite the economic conditions around the world.
I know, like during COVID when we weren't allowed to go, like leave our province, and I'm like, they think this is a punishment. Like I'm going to go to Kelowna, go to wine country, have some wine. I'm going to jet over to like Parksville, sit on the beach. Like, could you imagine being in Regina? Like, it's just, we're so spoiled here in BC with so much beautiful, beautiful cities.
World-class wine regions. World-class ski resorts.
Absolutely.
All within 6 hours of the city of Vancouver. You can surf in Tofino within 6 hours of Vancouver. Vancouver Island itself is stunning. You can spend your lifetime exploring different parts there. We are spoiled rotten.
Absolutely.
In British Columbia, and people are going to keep coming here. So how do we find a way to provide them housing in a really great way that looks good, works good, makes people feel good, and makes everybody better off.
Absolutely. Greg, we appreciate you taking the time today to unpack a little bit of how the entitlement process works, how the development steps work. But before we let you go, we have a six-pack of lighthearted questions. Do you have a few more minutes for us?
Of course.
First question up, when you find the time, Greg, favorite vacation spot?
Oh, I've got to throw two at you.
Sure, go right ahead.
Tofino is probably my favorite place on the planet.
Oh, good call.
There's something about being smacked in the face with a wave that clears the sinuses and clears the cobwebs. The second spot for me is Thailand. Been there a couple of times with my wife, honeymoon, and most recently a year and a half ago with my kids. Absolutely spectacular. Food is great. People are friendly, easy to get around, and incredibly affordable.
Great. Two great ones there. Tofino, I'll second that. Like when you go to Tofino, those who haven't been, it literally feels like you've been transported into another world. And you don't realize that, like you said, you're only 6 hours from the city, only a couple hours from the Central Island there. It's amazing, amazing spot. So you're in Tofino, you got off, you're done surfing, you're having a couple beers there, and someone shoves a karaoke mic in your face. Greg, what song are you singing?
I am quite literally terrified of karaoke, but if I absolutely had to it and I had sufficient alcohol in my system, probably Journey.
Oh, classic.
It's pretty classic. Everybody knows the words. You're probably not singing alone for long.
If you could go anywhere in the city for dinner or lunch, what's the favorite restaurant?
El Vio Volpe.
Oh, good call.
The sister restaurant, the Salvio Volpe over on Canby. Went there on a date night with my wife a few months ago. Absolutely spectacular food. Great atmosphere. You don't feel like you're in the city. You feel like you're in somewhere in California.
Yep. Nope. Great. Great one. Favorite TV show or movie?
I've been watching The White Lotus. I've just finished season three. Fantastic. But a movie rewatch actually is The Martian. I'm a bit of a science nerd. I've watched that The Martian movie easily 20 times. I never get tired of it.
I haven't seen White Lotus. I haven't gone down that rabbit hole yet.
Oh, you're missing out.
But the more and more everything you watch, Saturday Night Live, they're mocking it. I'm like, oh, I gotta go down this rabbit hole. So I'm holding on as long as I can, because I know once I get into the series, it's just game over for me. I'm stuck watching it over and over and over again to get caught back up. I feel like I'm missing out. Favorite band or musician?
I am partial to Mumford & Sons.
Okay, that's a good one.
About 15 years ago, they played at what was called Club 560 here in Vancouver. I was there with 200 other people.
Wow.
I snagged tickets. I was 6 feet from the stage, and they didn't play with amplified instruments, and it was the best concert I've ever been to.
Wow. Good one. Good one. Last question up. Do you have a book recommendation for our listeners? Doesn't have to be about real estate, but it can be.
Okay. Yeah. No, this one's definitely not about real estate. It kind of goes back to my love of surfing. There's a book called The Wave by Susan Casey. It came out, I think, 2010, 2011. And it's actually like a scientific / like psychological analysis of people's search for the perfect wave. And it's such a fascinating book. I've read it like 4, 5, 6 times. And when you can read a nonfiction book over and over again, you know, it's pretty interesting.
Well, Greg, how can our guests find out more about yourself and everything you're doing over there at the GDM Group?
Sure. Yeah. My website is gdmgroup.ca and my email is greg@gdmgroup.ca. And people are more than welcome to send me emails. I'm happy to meet people for coffee and just talk about this market we live in.
Amazing. Well, Greg, thank you so much for taking the time today to unpack it. We really appreciate it. And I encourage everyone who hasn't had a chance to go visit your website to do so. And you've always been so good and easy to reach. So I'd encourage people, if you have the questions, to reach out to you. Amazing.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks so much for your time, Greg. We really appreciate it. Take care. There you have it, folks. Our interview today with Greg Mitchell, director at GDM Consulting Group. I love having Greg on the thing. He's a world of knowledge. You know, I commented on the program today too. He's just real easy to get a hold of. He's always, always happy to talk real estate. And right now he makes a point on there about brokers are very optimistic in there. And I'll be the first to say that they are. And one thing a lot of guests say, and one thing we stress to a lot of clients is make sure you hire professionals around you, whether that be a mortgage broker or a commercial lawyer. Make sure you have the right team. And to Greg's point, having a good development consultant early on in your process is absolutely paramount. I won't say the property, nor will I say the city this property was in, but it was being pitched at this time at about a 5.2 FSR, which is what the OCP allowed for. So there was no miscommunication on the marketing side by the listing brokerage, but several clients looked at it. Everyone was trying to figure out why it wasn't selling too fast. So we also did a kind of a deep dive into it. And in this particular community, there's a 90-foot setback from tower to tower over top of the podium. And where this property sat, it sat within that 90-foot range. So you could not build a tower like the OCP would allow you to. It ended up selling to a retail company that I believe is building a single-story retail building with parking at dramatically less than what it was originally marketed 4 years ago. But that's a great example that if you don't understand setbacks and all these other things that kind of come in, you can't just look at an OCP and say, this is what it allows for me to build. I'm going to buy it and build it. There's a whole bunch of other requirements that have to come in from so many feet of frontage potentially and setback requirements and all of that stuff. So that's one example I wanted to share that it was something that we dug into. And you can see really quickly that if you didn't know what you were doing or you didn't have the right consultants involved early on, how you might pay a lot of money for something you can't build. So great having Greg on the program. I encourage everyone to reach out to him. And we'll be back next week with another great episode. And Melissa will join us as well. Thanks so much for listening, guys. Take care. Bye-bye.
Subscribe today.